You're listening to More Perfect Marketing, the show for business owners and entrepreneurs always on the lookout for smart marketing ideas to keep their business moving forward. And now, here's your host, David Baer.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of More Perfect Marketing. It's David Baer here. Today, we're going to be talking about the idea of customers and how central they are to your marketing, to your business. In fact, today's guest, right at the top of her business's website, it says, "We help you sell the way your customers want to buy." And I hear this a lot from marketers in general, and they will then launch into a discussion around what here in the marketing world we refer to as the buyer's journey, right? The awareness level of the customer. And then they're considering, am I going to move on to, you know, making that purchase? And then the decision point where they are either deciding to move forward or not. And I think as you listen to today's conversation, at least this is what I'm hoping is going to happen, you're going to discover that there's actually a lot more to what customers have to tell us and what customers and prospective customers think about and how they behave than that simple, you know, outline of those three steps actually might lead us to believe. And to guide us through this conversation is somebody who knows this well because she's been analyzing this for many years and has had lots of conversations with customers from her various clients. And that's Kristen Chivago, who is joining me from Rhode Island. Kristen, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks.
Indeed. So I want to dive into this discussion of, you know, what customers can tell us. But before we do, I want to kind of understand what got you to focus on this, as opposed to all of the other things that as marketers, we have the opportunity to focus on.
Yeah, I had a high-tech agency in Silicon Valley with my husband many years ago. And then the Mac came out and I said, he was our graphics guy. And I said, look, why don't you retire and go experiment? He made things. He was an inventor and an artist, an engineer and an artist. So he was happy for a long time after that. And I reinvented myself. I call myself a revenue coach, which basically is I teach CEOs and entrepreneurs how to make more money by understanding what their customers want to buy from them and how they want to buy it. And then I started this agency in 2017, our digital agency, Chivago Partners, because I could see a lot of established companies who had good products, good people, but they were like deer in the headlights when it came to digital marketing. And having been in tech and digital marketing, I thought, okay, got to help these people. So we've been doing that ever since. The thing that got me through all of those career shifts was that every time I started to work with a client, I would ask them as part of the onboarding process, I would ask them what they thought was important to their customers. And they would give me a list, basically. And then I would go interview their customers. And the list was different. And I thought, okay, we got a problem here. There's a gap. And as they say in the UK, mind the gap. And the gap is really a big problem because if you're not addressing something I call their mindset when they set out to buy, I think it's even more important than a persona. It's their desires, their concerns, and their questions. And that, to me, you have to specifically know what those are. If you guess, and everybody guesses because they don't want to talk to their customers, which is crazy. If you guess, you're going to guess wrong. And you're going to be just doing marketing speak. So if you actually interview customers after they've bought from you, because they won't tell you what they're thinking while they're buying from you, they're playing poker at that point, negotiating, basically. After they buy from you, they have a vested interest in your success, and they're happy to tell you what they were thinking as they went through that buyer's journey, as people now call it. I was one of the first people to identify there was even such a thing as a buyer's journey. So it's looking at selling from the buyer's perspective is what this is all about, but you can't guess.
Yeah. I like the idea that you know, raise about when you're asking, because I think it helps ensure that we have the right perspective. But I think that there's probably even more nuance than that, because if it's immediately after they bought, they are the reasoning is fresher and probably more accurate in their mind than, you know, a year after they bought, when you have to get them to think back to what were you thinking, or what was important to you at the time. And so I think there's probably, you know, some more on that subject that you could enlighten us on.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Congratulations. It's nuanced, and it's based on the product itself. So there, in my book, Roadmap to Revenue, I talk about the four types of products and services in the world based on the amount of scrutiny that the customer applies to the purchase. So there's light scrutiny, medium scrutiny, heavy and intense scrutiny products and services. Light scrutiny is see it, buy it. Just ask a few questions. Nobody else is involved. It's the candy bar at the checkout counter.
Yeah, impulse buy. Okay.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, low price, all of that. Medium scrutiny is something like clothing, let's say, on the B2C side, where usually there's not another person involved. You only have a few questions, more so than you did on the impulse purchase, and it costs a bit more, of course. And then heavy scrutiny is again on the consumer side. It's cars and houses. There's a salesperson involved. There's lots and lots of questions and concerns. Somebody else is often involved, a spouse or whatever. And then intense is all of that, plus you get married. It's a long time service engagement, or a Boeing aircraft, or, you know, a big project. So the buying process and somebody's memory about it, for the impulse purchase, you really should get in there pretty quick, because they're not going to remember all the thoughts they had about that candy bar outside of, you know, can my waistline afford it? That kind of thing. But the more medium and heavy scrutiny products, which a lot of the tech products fall into, you can wait. You have to wait until they've had time to experience the product or the service. And you'll know yourself about how long that would be. And those are the ones that you target.
I've also heard, and I'm curious if you do this, some discussion, mostly in the copywriting world, of interviewing people who don't end up becoming customers, and the insights that you can get from them as well.
Yeah, interestingly though, because I've done both, and what I found is that the people who buy from you oftentimes almost don't buy from you, because there are some things that the salesperson said, or that they were worried about, and they decided to buy from you anyway because it wasn't that big of a deal, whatever it is they were worried about, and they figured out a way around it or something. So the other thing you find out is that the people who buy from you, after they buy from you, they know more about your company, and they know your strengths and weaknesses, like how easy is it to get service, and how friendly were you when they called, and, you know, those after buying experiences. And by the way, one thing that marketers never talk about is what's going to happen to me after I buy. I don't know why we don't talk about it, but it's actually a better way to sell, because you're putting the person in the driver's seat and you say, here's what's going to happen, you know, once we take on your account, or you start using this thing, here's what you're going to discover. And that's a big concern for people. It's never addressed in the marketing copy.
Well, I would say yes, in the majority of places that as consumers and business buyers, you know, we might see. I'd say that there's probably in the direct response, you know, world, where there's the long form sales letters, there's a lot of future pacing, and so there's the painting the picture of what the future looks like, but you don't see that in most marketing. And I think that you know, that point is you know, well taken. We're talking about interviewing customers, and I want to make it clear, you are not running a market research firm. You're doing something very different, but you're utilizing something that more businesses and more marketers should utilize in their preparation for and maybe adjustment of existing marketing. And I wonder if you can sort of talk a little bit about how you put this into practice in the bigger picture of the work that you're doing.
I call these research projects a reality check. I'm always working with top management, and I want them to get the customer in their head, because they don't have the customer in their head. I got news for you. They don't. As a general rule, I mean, Lou Gerstner at IBM spent 40% of his time visiting customers, and he had been a customer of IBM. And I worked for IBM before, during, and after Lou Gerstner. And I can tell you that it was quite an interesting experience how much of his consumer-centric thinking actually got into that organization of 350,000 people, which is what they were when I was there. And it made a difference. I mean, you really could see that they were putting the customer first. The method that I spell out in my book, and I do this, I introduce the whole idea of becoming a buyer-centric seller in the first two chapters. But in chapter three, I say, here's how you get people on the phone. Here's how you interview them. And this is a simple process, and the marketers should do that themselves. If we're talking to marketers or agencies, they need to know enough about the product to have a conversation or the product or service with the person. They can't sell at any time during the interview, or they're going to lose that person. They're just going to get bored and drop off. They need to listen intently. They need to record the conversation. And I just tell people at the beginning, I have to record this because I can't type as fast as you can talk, and I want to get every word. But I'm going to anonymize your comments. I'm going to say, here's what everybody said in answer to this question. Here's this person, this person, this person. The beauty of that is that when the management gets the report, they see the similarity in the answers. I mean, people will actually say the same phrase, and five or seven people will say the same phrase to describe the strength or the weakness of the company. So it really gets into the management's head. Ooh, boy, they really, you know, this is a problem for them, or this is the why they bought from us. We didn't even realize that's why they bought from us. And by the way, you only have to interview 5 to 7 people of a given type. So let's say in a B2B sale, you've got a CEO and a user and a purchasing agent. You want to interview 5 to 7 people of each of those types. And that's it. You will get bankable, repeated information from those people. You will see the trend and be able to, and you'll get wonderful phraseology from them that you can use in your copy that other customers will recognize and say, that's me. That's not a marketing person talking. That's my kind of thinking.
I want you to speak more about that. So you're looking for, in these conversations, desires, concerns, and questions, you said.
Yeah.
And as you're collecting that, where do you practically apply that? And I obviously you talked about the different levels of scrutiny, and there's going to be different types of marketing for those different things that you're buying, that and I guess there's a different weight to all of these things in terms of use of or deployment of what you discover as well. So I know it's probably a 2-hour PowerPoint to answer the question I've just asked.
No, I can do it.
But I wonder if you can help sort of summarize it.
The thing that's interesting about this method, the more I did it, the more I realized, and by the way, I've done this for hundreds of companies and I've interviewed thousands of customers. Okay. So I've really gotten a full range over the years. And what was interesting is how different each company is, even companies in the same market. So someone might buy from you for a very specific reason, something that you've done with your product or service that just is exactly what they need. And they're really happy that you're emphasizing that because that's their main concern or whatever. And each company has a different type of management. The CEO is going to determine how the company makes decisions and what they care about, and what their background is, which then compels the company to behave a certain way if they have an engineering background or a finance background. So each company is different. And that's why one size fits all marketing doesn't actually work. It doesn't work. All of us as buyers know when they think they know who we are, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
We do. We just see it right away. And we also know if the copy was generated, you know, mechanically, so to speak. So we know that. And yet as sellers, we think we can get away with it.
Yeah.
And we're wrong. We can't. So it is individual to every single company.
You know, you bring this up, and I immediately thought of one of the stories that I tell a lot. Probably I've recorded it on this podcast a dozen times already, and that's the idea of differentiation through unexpected discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I will often tell the story of Claude Hopkins and Schlitz Beer, and the types of things that you can uncover in talking to customers may reveal to a business something that they didn't choose to position around, didn't choose to differentiate themselves with, but have now a new opportunity. I wonder, do you see that much? And
all the
and
time.
How do you leverage that? Sometimes it's a little difficult, I imagine, to convince a client to maybe change things. But
well,
you know better than I do.
It there's two things. One is thirsty horses. So I have a client who is the true thirsty horse, and I'll explain what that is. So he had a mentor who said, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And he was like, yeah, fine, whatever. And then the mentor looked at him and said, that's why I always look for thirsty horses. Okay. I'm always looking for thirsty horses. Number one, the CEO has to be willing to change. He or she has to be already open to the idea that they might learn something from their customers. And you can always tell when you give them, I have a rule, I don't work with jerks, and they're the ones that don't want to learn anything from customers. So I have a little jerk test, and if they pass it, I take them on as a client. If they don't, I back off.
So aside from their personality trait or flaw of being a jerk, how else do you identify this person is open to change? Is there like a discussion?
No, I think you can tell. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm sort of a marketing psychologist, all right, or business psychologist. It's not like I haven't seen all the behaviors. I just wrote an article we're publishing next week on my blog about the 10 terrible, toxic, company-killing traits of bad managers.
By the way, I love the double alliteration in there. That's nice.
It's actually triple. It's like terrible, toxic trait. The guy or the female, whoever it is at the top or whatever their pronouns are, they have to be the kind of person who's just open. They're not roughshodding over other people. You can tell when they're talking among their group how they respect their employees and the people work for them. And if they don't respect their employees, they don't respect their customers. If it's just, it goes together. I'm writing a new book about that and how companies have kind of lost the thread. They really don't understand the connection between making more sales, increasing their revenue, and happy employees. And happy customers, of course, and good systems and processes and all that. But this is something it's inbred in the person. They either have a desire to help and make things better, and they're humble enough to say, okay, you're right, I stand corrected. One of my team members says that all the time, stand corrected. This is the right way to go. They have to be open to it. If they're not, they're not going to even want to work with me. I'm that's what I'm all about, is selling the way your customers want to buy. And if you're not into that concept, then you're not going to succeed. It's pure and simple.
I guess when you're approaching the new relationship around the idea of selling the way your customers want to buy, there's the likelihood that there's going to be a change that may have to happen. So I interrupted you in the middle of your answer there. You were starting to sort of talk about what it might look like when you make a discovery to then implement a change or build on what you learn.
So In addition to the conversation report, which has the transcriptions of the conversations and all the answers that people gave, I also present them with what I call a summary and recommendations report. I pretty much summarize and bulletize the comments that we got from everybody. So it's really bubbled up. So you can really see the high level aspects of it. That's the strategy. I know you're into strategy and implementation. Yep. That's the strategy. And then we have a recommendation section that says, okay, these are your basic problems, your company name or the way you approach people, or here's your main theme or what they bought your product for, and you're not even addressing that for in any of your marketing. It's all kinds of things. It could be product related, it could be process related. One of my things that people quote me on a lot is that branding is the promise that you make. Your brand is the promise that you keep. And you've got five basic tools for keeping your promise: your products and services, your people, your processes, your policies, and your passion. If they don't have passion, it's not going to work. What I found being a revenue coach for so many years is that most companies, when they fail, assuming they have a nice person at the top, most companies fail because they don't have good processes. So the employees are frustrated and the customers are frustrated. And that's what makes them not great. I mean, the reason Jeff Bezos is as rich as he is because he built an infrastructure into which he put books, and then he could put, you know, shower accessories or whatever he wanted. But he started with the infrastructure. And I noticed that when he first came out, I was in Silicon Valley and I thought, this is the first tech company I've ever seen that didn't start with a product or a service and this idea, you know, this inventor's idea. It was the infrastructure. And boy, has he showed how to leverage that.
And surprisingly, not many businesses have taken that cue and actually, you know, copied it. And we still have a lot of the same bad habits.
I agree.
In our space in marketing, but certainly in business model. I am regularly referring new business owners all the time to this guy named Michael Gerber, who wrote a book years and years and years ago about what you're talking about, right? Building systems and teach the people how to work the system.
Yeah. And they should be good systems. They should be intuitive and quick and not double entry and not frustrating. Just get your work done. I mean, the first person I hired when I started this company was an infrastructure manager. I knew we were going to run our business on the cloud, no question. So I needed an app whisperer to go out there and figure out, you know, which apps are going to be better. For project management, we ended up with something called Avaza, which is not a very well-known program. But you can go from estimating to project to invoicing with just a click of a button all the way through. It's so cool. And the project management tools are exactly what you need. So it makes a big difference to the happiness of employees and the longevity of employees and to customers, to clients.
You talked about this cloud foundation, and it reminds me that I was learning a little bit about your background, you actually started a business called Cloud Potential.
And
I'm curious, what brought you from the management consulting, planning stuff, revenue coach role that you were playing into this sort of world of cloud-based stuff, and then ultimately to building the business that you have now?
Well, I was always in tech. I mean, I started out, honestly, I was the first woman to sell machine shop tools in the United States when I was 17. And I was so humiliated because they just gave me a catalog, said, wear your mini skirt, you know, this is way back, and you'll be fine. And I could not tell the foreman of one particular shop. He said, okay, honey, well then tell me how your drill bit's better than the one I'm using now. And I couldn't. So I went out to my old 51 Chevy and I said to myself, I'm going to learn everything I can about selling and tech. And I've been doing that ever since. So that's kind of what started me on this thing. So in 2014, before I started this company, I partnered with one of my clients. And both of us wanted to start a cloud-based company. We wanted the whole cloud. And he ended up going and starting a business to teach people how to make websites and, you know, sort of an educational group. I think they call it the CloudWise Academy or something. But we parted company in 2017. We were just going in different directions. But that's kind of what shifted me again, because I saw good business managers having a terrible time with digital marketing. It just wasn't working for them. They weren't getting the leads they needed. They didn't understand how to manage it. And honestly, they were often being taken advantage of by people who just left them in the dark.
Yeah,
I thought that was criminal, frankly.
So now you have Zhivago Partners. And as I'm looking through the website and the range of services that you cover, it is all informed heavily by what the customer, I wrote down a quote of yours somewhere. It was, marketing begins and ends with the customer.
Yeah.
And then I look through the website and I see a lot of different activities that you engage in with prospective customers. And one would hope also retention of existing customers.
Oh, of course.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, sort of how you operate and who you're serving through those different services.
We always come in the middle of their movie. So they might have a marketing director, they might not. They might have been doing SEO and didn't get anything from it because it wasn't being done correctly, or they might have tried social marketing. A lot of times they come to me and say, oh, I tried that. I tried social marketing, whatever, and it didn't work. But because they never went to the customer and they never got the message right, I mean, if your content isn't relevant to your customers, they're just going to click away. That's what happens. We all do it every day. So that was the real big, that's the overarching theme of everything we do. So I always do the reality check before we start working. I always figure out what they're doing already and what they need to do. Excuse me. And when I interview the customers, they tell me how they would buy this type of product. It's one of the questions I ask. What's your typical buying process? If you were typing into search engine and we're looking for this again, what would you type in? You know, so I learn what they need, and then we build the program for that.
I'm curious, as you say, this is the question I asked them, and then they tell me how they do that. How accurate do you think those answers are versus, and is there a way to check the reality? Because I'm thinking how I would answer that question, and I don't know that I would actually be able to reflect what I actually do as opposed to what I would hope I would do.
Well, don't forget you're a marketer though.
This is true.
Right? Yeah. So some part of your brain is thinking along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
When I talk to an engineer, you know, about some technical product that they bought, they're not thinking that way. They're totally focused on telling you the story of what they went through.
Yeah.
And they're actually proud of it because they made a good decision and they're happy with their decision. My husband was very technical and he was very proud of how he made good decisions. And when he got a product, man, it was the right product, right? And all the reasons.
Yeah.
He was like a walking spreadsheet about the pros and cons. So again, because you talk to 5 to 7 people of a given type, and because they all agree with each other, you get little nuances as you talk to a few more, but the basic process and what they went through and their desires, their concerns, and their questions are totally in line.
Okay. I can see that now. As you're working through this process, you hear a theme, you hear a motif, and so the consistency of answers is what reinforces that there's actually legitimacy behind what you're getting.
Exactly.
So I want to make sure that folks know you've mentioned a book a few times, but we haven't said what it's called. Roadmap to Revenue, How to Sell the Way Your Customers Want to Buy. Where can folks find that? And where can folks find out more about you?
Amazon. I just stuck with Amazon. There's an audio version. There's a Kindle version. There's the hardcover. Actually, I prefer that people buy the hardcover because the last half of the book goes through a workflow process of the buying process for the light, medium scrutiny, heavy and intense scrutiny products and services. And it's much easier to get that data from a print book. Mm-hmm. My next book isn't going to have that restriction, I don't think. But anyway, that's what I recommend. Zhivago Partners is our website. And
that's zhivagopartners.com. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. And if you just Google Kristen Zhivago, I will dominate the first, 35 until you get to Kristen Chenoweth or somebody like that, or Dr. Zhivago.
Yes.
So there's plenty of easy ways to find me if you just do that.
And perhaps the easiest way is if you're listening to this podcast, there will be show notes with a link to your website as well. And so we'll make sure to leave that in there. And I will also put a link to the book available on Amazon.
Great. Thank you.
So, hey, Kristen Zhivago, thank you so much. This has been a really enlightening conversation about how important, and perhaps more important than we know, customers are to our businesses.
Yes. Well, great interview. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much. Folks, you've been listening to More Perfect Marketing. If you know somebody who could benefit from listening to the episode you just heard, please send them our way. Until next time, my name's David Baer. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to More Perfect Marketing. Now you can put what you've learned here into practice when you join the free listener community at mpmcommunity.com. That's mpmcommunity.com. When you join today, you'll receive David's collection of 26 smart marketing cheat sheets to help you master your marketing, plus additional business building training. So don't delay. Join us today at mpmcommunity.com. We can't wait to welcome you.